thank you for getting up at this hour. I was on my way in and made a joke on Twitter that I was going to find out who really wanted to be a writer, because with Gen Con's schedule to get up at 8 a.m. to talk about what it's like to be a writer actually shows that you're either smart enough or dumb enough. I'm not sure which.
Or you didn't party that hard last night.
We're going to talk about kind of some behind-the-scenes stuff as far as what it's like to be a writer, what that life's like. I kind of thought, knowing in advance that a lot of people would be kind of starting out and looking for ways to move forward, that instead of just jumping into the deep end of what it's like for us now, that I would kind of start out with some questions and some things of how we started out. So maybe we'll start down here with John. If you want to introduce yourself and maybe briefly talk about when you realized you wanted to be a writer. how that mystical thing
in the womb.
First, I was born.
Now you tell the truth.
I wrote on my mother's wall.
What
the? My first horror story.
Yeah. In vitro.
Yeah.
We should probably do introductions.
Do that with your introduction.
There you go. Okay. My name is John Helbers. I've been at this business from all sides, writing editorial and everything, for 16 years. I used to work for Technobooks, the largest book packager in America, and probably the world. And so I left last October to begin doing total freelance editorial writing. Actually, I first realized I wanted to be a writer probably when I was a kid, but I never thought I'd actually break in. So it took until I sold my first short story, and I was holding the contract in my hand, like, holy crap, I really can do this. Like 10 years ago-ish, or longer, I can't remember, 97, whatever that. Back in mists of ancient time.
Dinosaurs in 97?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I just kept going from there. And, work. But I cheated. I did it through my day job. So that was how I did it.
Thanks. You know how I cheated?
Yes.
This is my husband. That's how I cheated. I slept with my editor. No. I too wanted to be a writer ever since I was a child. A writer. Our artist was always first. Writer was.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
The doors are locked, apparently, so it's off the Thunderdome, Come in and then no one leaves.
One of you will leave with a publishing contract.
Did you see them all like. Sharpening the pens.
He's like, I can take them.
We didn't say what the contract would be.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
In perpetuity.
You get to be the coffee monkey. Yeah.
So
anyway, I'm Carrie Hughes, and like I said, I, from childhood I wanted to be an artist first. But I also wanted to be a writer. But I was shite at writing. And I can't explain it. I think it has something to do with me being a visual person rather than an intellectual, let's get these thoughts down on paper and be organized about them. And I was an artist. And then I met him and helped him with a compendium of work with research. And I love research. It's ridiculous. I love research. But then I wrote a story. And again, you get the check in your hand and the contract. And you're like, holy crap. Somebody wants to read what I wrote. And then I was like, I'm going to do that now. And I have been since then. And I've got 13 anthologies and 13 short story sales, and I'm working on 5 books right now.
Not all at once?
No, yes, I am, actually. All 5, well, some
one
of them...
One sentence at a time.
It's usually working. Ask me about that later, and we'll go through that.
I was going to say, we're going to talk about multiple projects later.
Yes, we will.
My name's Jerry Gordon. I'm the co-editor of the Dark Faith series and the Last Right series of books. I do that as an editor, as a writer, a dozen professional short stories out there, and my End of the World thriller, alternative history book, Breaking the World, next year, comes out through Apex Publishing, so 2013. As far as when I realized I wanted to, I was incredibly into books and movies as a kid, had no idea, never conceived of the idea that there were people who actually went and did that stuff. It really wasn't until college. I was a telecommunications major. My voice was this low when I was about 12. So I actually worked for radio stations as a teenager.
Good for picking up kids in the studio.
Yeah, yeah. And I decided I didn't want to do that, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. And my family didn't have a lot of money, so I was very guilty about not knowing what I wanted to do. So I just kind of buried myself in the library looking for some answer. And I chanced across a couple of biographies from directors and writers, and everything they were describing about their lives sounded so similar to my childhood that it started to dawn on me at that point that this was something you could go do.
I'm Gregory Wilson. I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's University. I teach courses in fantasy, science fiction, and creative writing, and others. I'm an author also. My first novel came out a couple of years ago, ably edited by that gentleman all the way at the left end of the table. I have a short story that just came out in an anthology called When the Villain Comes Home, edited by Ed Greenwood and Gabrielle Harbouy, and starring some members of the Symposium also. And I am co-editing an anthology on speculative fiction and politics, also with a gentleman all the way to my left. We've been doing some work on that here. And then last, I host a podcast called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans, along with Brad Bollier, speculative fiction author, also in the Symposium.
Terrific.
Thank you. Which happens to have interviewed Jerry Corden and also Steve.
And Stephen. That's why. It's
and
terrific.
I was going to say, I was like, inside the writer's studio, where we all hang out with each other. And Stephen Soss as well, and a number of other authors, Brandon Sanderson, Brent Weeks, Ian McDonald, most recently Saladin Ahmed and Betsy Wolheim from DAW, talk about their work. That is at speculatesf.com. I had basically two interests growing up in particular as a kid. One was music, which for a long time I thought I was going to pursue, and I still to this day actually play in a progressive rock band, he said, shamefully. The other thing was interest in language, not just written, but actually oral language. My father was an English professor. My mother had been an actress and a French teacher. And so a lot of what I did sort of growing up, I was surrounded. My father had like a library of 5,000 books, and I was, you know, I had this dog-eared copy of The Hobbit that was an original that he had marked up. My father tended to mark things up in the margins so you could like read along with his reaction when he was reading it, you know. And then blah, 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 Gollum comes out, and then you get this, "Don't trust him!" and exclamation points. And I was like, my father went down this trail before. So,
what's that? Twain did that.
Yeah. And in fact, my dad used to comment about that because I brought that up to him when I was older, and he said, you know, well, such people as Mark Twain. You know, I was like, yes, Dad, I know. You were in great company. So I was interested in the power of language, and when I got into college and I decided that music maybe wasn't going to be the ultimate sort of goal, I started moving towards language specifically, and actually my real first introduction to the use of it was in debate, and I did collegiate debate and coached it and became fascinated at the ability of language to shape and alter the way that we see the world for both good and ill, sadly, many times. And that gradually got me into interest in writing and the power of writing as well, and I actually got my start as a creative writer right here at Gen Con in a panel called Big on the Small Press with that gentleman all the way down at the left end of the table, and ended up working with him, and then my career went from there. So I wasn't entirely sure at the beginning, but it was always about the interest in what language and words and rhetoric could do.
And never forget, Greg, I own you.
Yes, I know.
And I was going to say, you have just made him the most popular person at the end of this panel.
That's just, also this gentleman. Yeah, exactly.
For two guys joined at the hip, how are you sitting so far apart?
They are not joined at the hip.
No.
That was just to throw the wife off. So that there's no suspicion.
For a long time.
My name's Steve Soss. I bought a generic for being a panelist up here, so I guess that's why. Where else am I going to get to tell that joke? Come on. I'm an author. I'm also a small/micro publisher, depending on how you define things. The most recent thing that we put out is Eighth Day Genesis, which you may have seen some people here. It's a world-building book. Carrie's in it. And it's, for me, I'm also an author as well. And I got started actually with a mimeographed magazine in second grade. Where they actually made it at school and then got teased mercilessly for the rest of the year. But I didn't actually start writing for any kind of professional thing until I came in second place for a science writing contest with Seed Magazine a couple of years back. More than a couple of years back. I just like to not pretend I'm that old. And then from there, it's like they actually flew me out to New York. And I was like, oh, wow, this is awesome. And then I didn't sell anything for 2 years. But at that point, I actually wandered into one of these panels because it was my first year at Gen Con. I didn't register for games until late. And I'm like, well, crap, what am I going to do? Hey, there's that writing thing that'll help with the GMing. And then I proceeded to spend the rest of the con at these panels. And, yeah, pretty much that's what I've done at Gen Con ever since, on one side of the table or another. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. So now I've got a bunch of short fiction credits to my name and some a lot of good stuff that I've helped put out that other people have done as well. So
why don't we talk a little bit about something that I don't hear enough about on these kind of panels, which is, so you figured out you want to be a writer. Talk about just a little bit about early mistakes.
I'm going to start at the other end of the table. Not that I haven't made any, don't get me wrong.
I'll tell you what.
My test is a little bit different.
Yeah, I'll start and give you guys time to think about that. Since I created the question, I probably have an answer. early mistakes. Okay, first of all, one of the things that almost every writer gets asked is, where do you come up with your ideas? That's because there is a misconception that I personally shared as I started thinking about becoming a writer, that the idea is the big thing. That, well, you can learn how to write, you can learn how to write well, which is true. But, you know, the idea is this magical thing that, you know, if you either have the ability to come up with it or you don't. And so I proceeded from that misconception. And, you know, that it took me a while to work my way around the idea not being the big thing, the execution of the idea being the big thing. The other thing is I wrote a book first. And any of you who are considering getting started, don't write a book first. And I will say this on almost any panel I'm on, and I'll say it because every writer has ticks to work out in how they write. No matter how talented you are, no matter how schooled you are. I've got one of my degrees is in English, and I started out writing horribly. But when you're writing a book, not only is it a really long slog to even finish, and you may not have the energy to finish, but that's a long time to wait to get comments on what you are and aren't doing right. You can take a couple weeks, write a story, have people look at it, learn what you are doing well, what you're not doing well. So the starting with the novel was probably the biggest freshman mistake.
Now I'll jump in.
Okay.
And I'm going to disagree with you, Jerry. I don't think some people are just better in book form than short story. I agree with that. What I'm going to say is don't expect your first novel to be published, okay? That's what I think that's where it wasn't a mistake necessarily. But, you know, Larry Block and all the greats have Trump novels that will never, ever, 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 ever see the light of day because you're learning your craft during that.
Mm-hmm.
Short story writing and novel writing, there are different techniques, there are different beats. Some people just don't write short fiction. Some people don't write long fiction, although it's really hard to make a living not writing long fiction. But it's not, you have to write what speaks to you. So I wouldn't call it as a mistake. It was a learning experience.
Yeah,
that says all it was.
Well, when I think of it as a mistake, what I think of is the amount of time it took me to learn.
But you did learn during it. It's not like, okay, that novel's done. I'm going to start over and make the exact same mistakes. No, no.
No, I'm stubborn enough that I kept going with it.
I'll keep going now, actually, because I did actually, while he was talking, I actually thought about the problem I had was one of, it's not quite validation, but because I worked for a book packager and several of my early sales were internal, I have a real problem counting myself as a real writer. This is very common to writers from very well-known people that they're always afraid that someone's going to come and say, you're a big fat bully. And all your ideas were gotten from Warehouse in Poughkeepsie. I'll tell you the address later, Jerry, don't worry. And all this stuff, and I had to go through several years and actually get my first novel outside of techno books and my first magazine sale for Cemetery Dance. Several years later, I had short fiction published, and I knew I could write, but it was getting those outside of my little insular world and realizing that, yes, there are other people besides here, and that's where I listened to branching out and going to other kinds of stuff. Teach me. So mine was, as I said, I did cheat, I'll be honest with you. I didn't go through the whole slog and collect, 50 rejections or hundreds or however many, although my first rejection was memorable because it was from Poppy Z. Bright. That was fun. She was very nice about it, but just so like, no. So I think my mistake was jumping in thinking I could do a level of writing above what I really was at that point. So I kind of reached, seated, grasped at that particular stage in the game. That was my fifth story of a role, and I was writing the Love and Bane series, and I was like, okay, maybe I should go back and reevaluate a few things. So that'd be my biggest one.
You know, that kind of sends me right into mine. Kind of different from what I was going to talk about, but you guys have summed this up very nicely, because my biggest mistake is I'm having a hideous time finishing a novel because I know I have so many people around me waiting for me to fail. And I'm not saying he is. I'm just saying that when you're in the writers, I'm not even saying these guys are. But there are a lot of people.
there are people who want you to
they
not
want
succeed.
You to not
they
succeed.
See it as a zero-sum game.
Yes. As if you didn't succeed, they didn't fail either. Or the other way around, like it means they're better than you are.
Which is demonstrably false, by the way.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. It is.
And evil.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
And you're going to find that a lot. And because I've met... Just because I was associated with Martin H. Greenberg, through John, a lot of people are like, well, she slept with her editor, she cheated. And it's like, I assure you, if it wasn't good writing, it wouldn't have gotten in there, because there is a couple of levels of editor, and I'm looked at 20 times harder than anybody coming in and saying, I have a story, please, because I can't, they would not let, oh, boy, they were tough. Oh, tough. But I needed that. I needed someone to be tough because I was a good artist. I may go back to doing some art as well. I'm trying to do both. It's very hard to do that. Very hard to do that.
An interesting point, by the way, if you're in a group of wannabe writer friends, the first one who succeeds will find out who his or her friends really are.
Yes.
I hate to say it. I don't want to say it because you think it's going to be very positive about it. Some people cannot take that.
Nope.
Someone in your group succeeded first. And
then
I've talked to many pros who've had the same problem, and it's destroyed some friendships.
So my biggest mistake is on one I'm committing now every day when I get up, where I sit there and I go, can I do this? And the days that I don't write are the days that I have failed. The days that I do write are the days that I walk around, going, yes, 4,000 words, and they're all pretty good. And the next day you go look at them, and you're like, no, 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 no. Because I was an editor first. So I'm still working on that. But by this time next year, God damn it, I'm going to have at least I'm going to have all five done. Because I've had some people whipping me into shape recently, like Dean Wesley Smith and Chris Catherine Rush, and they freaking sit down and write like 5,000 words a day when they're really going on a book. And they teach classes at the same time. I'm like, how are you doing this? And they have day jobs. Or other people that I know that are writers had day jobs. And they're like, oh, I eke it out at this time and this time, whether I feel like it or not. And Neil Gaiman said something very smart that I was going to stay with me, that the words you write when you have a bad headache are just as good as the words you wrote when you were feeling inspired and happy. And so... write them even when you don't feel like you're writing them.
And it does get easier.
It is getting
very
easier.
Very torturous at first as you're trying to put it together. But it does get, once you start figuring out what you do wrong and how to work around your little quirks, it gets faster. An example would be my first torturous book took 5 years to write. Oh. And I was working at the same time, full time. but it was 5 years of little scraps of time. The book I just finished, I did in 2 months.
That's excellent.
But that was the window the publisher gave me.
Oh.
Well, I got 3 months to do it, but I
the deadline is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, there was no time.
What John says about, and actually what Carrie said about the idea of being around people who want you to fail, or specifically what John said, someone is going to find out, you know, that you're a phony, they're going to call your bluff. And in the author's mind, this is always a very public revelation that will occur. You know, you'll be, like, I'll be speaking at this panel and someone will, you were terrible, and now everyone knows it, you know.
And, right now.
You know, and it's like the days when you're back in high school and you tripped in front of the school and thought, in the cafeteria, and thought, this when I run for president, people will be like, do you remember that time that you, you know, your whole life will be defined by the time you tripped in the cafeteria. And, of course, that's nonsense, right? It's utterly untrue. But that authors are often deeply insecure people, in part because not only do we rely on other people to validate what we do, both in terms of getting it published in the first place and then actually reading it, this idea that authors don't look at, I never look at my sales numbers on Amazon, is ridiculous. Everybody does that. And the reason is not because they necessarily want their ego stroked, but they want to know that what they said, what they created, actually resonated with someone somewhere. And it's terrifying to think that that's not the case, that might not be the case. And so one of the big mistakes that I made at the beginning was spending far too much time not, you know, questioning and hoping that other people fail. I have never been like that. But feeling as if the fact that everyone else around me, because I was either lucky or unlucky enough to hang out with a bunch of super talented people who were all in the same field, you know. And it's very difficult if you're doing a show like Speculate and to constantly be interviewing people like Pat Rothfuss and Brandon Sanderson and Nora Jemison and Kiz Johnson and James Kelly and John Kessel. And all these people are just like, Hugo, Nebula. And publishing credits and this long, extensive history. It's very hard to look at that and be like, well, I have a book and I'm, you know. I'm a writer. It's very hard to do that. And the truth, of course, the actual truth, is that a rising tide lifts all boats, and that the more that all of us succeed, the better it is for the industry in general, and that there is a certain rhythm to the way that these things work, so that the more that you begin to work and immerse yourself in the craft, and the more you begin to spend time with these people and become friends with them, genuine friends with them, and begin to network and work on your craft, you will move in the direction that you need to move, and your work is eventually going to get there if you put all of those sort of, if you get all your ducks in a row. And that's really an important thing that I had to remember, was that it was not about a string of failures that I was eventually going to. I was thinking about it always in the wrong way. When I first met John and started talking to him about doing this book, The Third Sign, I, at that point, already had my PhD. My backup plan, if I didn't become a writer, was I was going to get a tenure-track job, because that was a good idea, right? 48% chance of getting a tenure-track job ever in one's lifetime now if you get a PhD. So I had a tremendous practical system for my life, apparently. But it ended up working out. And I did get a tenure-track job and got tenured and so forth. And so I was in the process of just starting my teaching career. And I was about, I guess, 2 years in at St. John's when I met that John. And started talking to him about this book. And I had written it in 2002, started writing in 2002, finished it in 2004, started querying without result. And in 2005, when I met him at Gen Con, I was kind of uncertain about where I was going to go with it. And in this small press panel, John had impressed me with a lot of the things that he had said about what Techno and Five Star was doing and his process in that. And I spoke to him about it, and there was a part of me that was not really, did not want to go up and talk to him and say, I have academic article credits, I have a PhD, I have a tenure track job, but I really don't have a lot of creative credits to my name. You don't know me from Adam. I'm sure I'm the 850th person you've talked to today that said, hey, I have this book, but would you be interested in taking a look at it? But I had to get over that stage of, I really feel uncomfortable doing this, and say, I think I do have work that is worthy to be looked at, and paid attention to, despite all of the demons saying to me, you're not really as good as, you know, everyone else is better than you. I had to get over that. And by doing that, and by talking to John, and by learning about the process of how important revision is, how important editing is, how important constant work on the craft to become better is, I started getting over those demons. They don't ever, I think, entirely go away. No matter where you arrive in your career, I would argue even best-selling authors, you know, there's a part of them that thinks, is the next book going to do as well? Am I going to eventually fade? Are people going to think of me as a one-book wonder or a two-book wonder or a three-book wonder? And I've talked to authors who say this, that it doesn't go away entirely. The voices don't go away entirely. But if you spend your time thinking about the ways in which you are likely to fail, you are, not surprisingly, likely to fail. It is incumbent upon you, I think, to try to think about ways to succeed. And that means being realistic, but it also means being, to a certain degree, optimistic in a field which has its great share of pessimism. And so a mistake I made was sort of letting myself give in, at least early on, to that pessimism, and I had to work to overcome that.
I think one of the reasons you keep hearing the same things is because, honestly, managing your ego, or lack thereof, is really it. All the rest of this stuff, you will write your 10,000 words of crap and get it out of your system. You know, you will do all these, you will work on your craft, you will do all these other things if you keep writing. Actually, one of the local authors that I work with, or local for me authors that I work with, I have to keep telling her, no, really, I wouldn't have bought your stuff if it wasn't good. But I've been rejected 5 times so far this year, and I'm like, yes, and I've been rejected 10. What's your point? You know, and taking rejection personally, going from that height of the words that spill out are pure genius. Ha ha. I won't need to edit this at all. Yes, you do. And then on the other hand, I've been rejected. Obviously, that means that I have failed as a person. No, it may mean something else. Like, Jerry just recently rejected me. Because both Jerry and Jennifer Brozek is not here this year. Both of them did me a great service, and other authors, because I've talked to other people you rejected for the Dark Faith too, by saying, "And here's all the other, here's some of these other people," you know. So it's like by talking, like, "Oh, I was rejected along with Jay Lake for one anthology. I'm okay with that."
Jay you know? Lake was rejected.
Yes.
Shame on
no,
you.
Actually, no. I didn't. That wasn't him.
Chitch was like, no, no.
No, that wasn't him. You know, but I mean, when you find out
he still gets rejected, right. Chris Rush yeah. gets rejection, and she'll be the what, first to tell you.
Because
you have what 700 something.
Yeah. For this book right here, unsolicited, we had 700 submissions.
Huh? You
yes.
slushed?
They slushed.
Oh yeah.
Oh my God! Yeah. I think there should be. Writer patches, like with the Girl Scouts and stuff, or like I slushed an anthology.
Yeah, it was funny. Last year I was doing an editing panel with Jean, and she's like, "Well, you know, you need to talk to Jerry about this." I'm like, "Jean, I've edited 3 books. You've done how many?" You know, feeling of you know there are more experienced people in the room. And she's like, "How many submissions did you get?" And yeah, this is a second in the series. First one got 600 over 4 months, but it was nominated for Stoker, Nebula, Black Quill, a bunch of awards. The second one we opened for unsolicited submissions for 1 month, 700.
Yep.
Now, 7 of those 700 got in. 2 of those 700 had never sold a story before.
Yep.
Wow.
And it's just a matter of, you know, the reasons you get rejected may have nothing to do with how good your story is, for whatever reason. But honestly, this is why I occasionally will go and watch some horrible, horrible freaking movie. It's like I watched, Mega Shark versus Crocosaurus recently. Right? This is like makes Transformers 2 look smart, kind of stupid. Okay? And I'm going, okay, I could write this drunk. I could write this drunk, ease and asleep. And somebody made it into a movie? Okay, I must not suck that bad. You know, it's just one of those, it helped get over that self-doubt, and so that I will keep writing and get through all the crap. And so even if you're going, oh, God, this sucks, I don't know how I'm going to get out of it, just keep going. And that stop letting the self-doubt stop you is, I think, probably the biggest thing that kills new writers.
Yeah, we have a saying, when you see things like that or read things that are terrible, or you read the opening of 50 Shades of Grey and you go, what? Yeah, is that somebody wrote this. Somebody else said it's okay. And uh-huh. somebody else said, here's a check.
Right.
I can keep writing.
Well, and to kind of tie off that, I want to ask everybody for a minute to talk about some type of break they got early that helped them with their writing career.
You already know mine, so get...
But to tie into what Steve's saying here,
we're in a club.
Not that club. Yeah.
To tie into what Steve's saying, one of the best things that I did early on, I finished that torturous first book, and I knew it needed to be revised. And I knew that was going to take, it took a couple of years to write, so I figured it was going to take a while to revise. But I had read a lot of publishing industry, how to succeed type books, and they're almost all incorrect in almost every way. And this entire idea of coming to a convention and pitching somebody seemed so scary to me that I just decided, before I have anything to sell, why don't I just start going to these and meeting people and seeing what it's like and getting to know people? And actually, this was the first con that I ever went to. I'm local in the city, so it was an easy one to go to. And I met Tim Wagner here, who has written, 25 books?
At least.
Yeah. He's a terrific guy. He's a really good writer. And we were talking, and he gave me probably one of the best pieces of advice that I ever could have gotten. At the beginning, which I went to lunch with him, which that was very kind of him. But he said, you know, I've written over 20 books. I get rejected 10 times for every sale I get.
Wow.
He's like, now I've written 10 books. Now each thing I write, it's going to get rejected on average 10 times before I sell it. Mm-hmm. And he said, so don't. You're going to get rejected a lot. Don't take it personally. Don't take each rejection as a need to completely reevaluate whether you're a writer and whether or not what you're doing is good. You know, he said, send it out. If you get 10 rejections back, maybe look at the story again. You know, or, you know, better yet, write a new story. But don't take the rejection because as you can already tell, writing is a very small community. There are half a dozen people that I really love in the business that I get to see this week that I told, no, they can't be in the anthology I edited.
And he's still alive.
Yeah. And you know,
so far.
Stay tuned.
So far. Yeah. But anyway, starting to go, and Tim and Elizabeth Vaughn and Jean and a couple other people convinced me to go to more conferences. Where I met more writers and then got introduced to Maurice, who I've done a couple books with. And so that really starting to go to things like this, and not only meeting people who are on panels, but meeting each other, mm-hmm. because a couple of you in here are going to start being up here, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you know each other, you'll start helping each other.
Yeah.
And all boats do rise with the tide.
Yeah. If there's one thing that's... Because doing the publishing thing has taken a crap ton of my time. And so if you ever think about the self-publishing thing, remember that last sentence. But one of the things that's made it worthwhile is being able to see some of the people... Because I've only been on this side of the table now, 3 years, I think? Something like that. And then already being able to help other people that I've heard or I've read their work and say, oh, hey, that's awesome. Here's an invite to this anthology that I'm publishing, you know. And some of them got in and some of them didn't, and that's fine. But, it, you know, being... So some of the people that you'll see on the panels, you know, I had something to do with it, because that's what happened to me. I actually was at a read... I was at a series of read and critiques here, mm-hmm. and I
was reading and critiquing them.
Yeah, that's right. You were there for that one. And, yeah, then it ended up grossing Gene out, and then... And then at which point she ended up going, hey, you know, I've got this anthology. Would you like something? You know, and it's like, sure. And she's like, okay, can you have it done by Tuesday? Like, okay. And then I went down to the bar and rocked out a first draft that sucked, and then like sweated until Tuesday and turned the thing in. But it's one of those, it's that sort of thing. So I mean,
well, and then
it wasn't just networking. It was here is a legitimate way to show my work, which wasn't just hey, I've got my thing. I'm going to slip it to you under the bathroom stall. It was a I'm looking.
Don't do that, Michael.
Yeah, don't do that. No.
It's yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to hear all these people talk about this idea of community, because the thing about writing is that it's a very solitary, often lonely activity, and it's one of the reasons that one of the things I like most, actually, about writing, I love sometimes I don't even love the process, although I do, other times I do, but I love having this thought that I've finished and completed something that I feel good about, that may need work, but that I feel good that there's some potential there. But I also really, really enjoy doing this. I have always loved not just being on panels and getting a chance to speak to all of you and see people like Steve who, started with, these stories, this read and critique thing, this story that was really, really good, and then, ending up on this side of the table, as we've said, but also getting a chance to sort of see a common group of people that you respect and admire do something impressive and do work that you respect and feel like you're a part of that community, which can be very inspiring. And that my break really, connects into that. Obviously, one of my breaks was getting a chance to meet John and working with him on this book, which he did not at first accept, by the way. I had to, resubmit it to him. And John, to his, credit, and for which I will always be grateful, did not immediately say, "And never contact me again, you jackass." He said, there's some things that, you need to, I don't know about, and I revised it, and I said, well, maybe look at this, and what about this? And then he said, okay. And we sort of went from there. So obviously one big break was meeting John. And another big one was getting a chance to network with people like Gene Raby and Paul Jeunesse, also a member of the symposium, who introduced me to Gene. Gene, who eventually ended up buying 3 articles for the CIFWA Bulletin that she edits. And many of us will have these sort of common stories about people that we knew and came in contact with. So I think one of the biggest breaks was recognizing that things that I had spent most of my life and career working on, which was my ability to communicate, hopefully my ability to articulate, hopefully my ability to connect with people, which is what I principally love about this anyway. It's the ability to produce something that other people get value and interest out of, and to know that what I produced in my mind had some impact on them. That those things that I had worked on since I was very young are things that came through in this medium too. And that I had not, in other words, just sort of kind of spun my wheels until, at the age of 35, I'm like, now I've figured it out. But that I was actually working towards doing something like this and is doing something like I do in my teaching career. All of those were things that I had been working on for a while. So for me, the big break, in part, was meeting folks like this. What was nice for me was to realize I had been, in a way, working towards what made that big break possible for much of my life to that point.
Well, and one thing to add to that really quick, it's a very small community of people. Be nice. Be easy to work with.
Right.
It's a job.
Right.
I mean, we all love it. It's a job. If you're a real pain in the ass, you better be brilliant, because that's the only way anybody will put up with you. And the people who in the business are pain in the asses are brilliant, because otherwise they'd be gone.
And a lot of them do kind of drop off. They get a little, I hate to tell you this, but they get blacklisted on a lot of reasons. If we don't know somebody, and we'll call somebody who we think knows that person and say, what are they like to work with? Can I handle them? Can they handle what I need to do? And we talk to each other. We gossip like crazy.
Because
it's a small community, everyone knows everyone, so it's not a good idea to burn bridges accidentally or otherwise.
Well, how you accept rejection is as important as how you accept.
Question? Or are you telling us we're over time?
No, I'm not. Actually, what I wanted you guys to do was give some examples of what burning bridges is, because when I heard this in a panel one time, I spent the next 5 years scared to death.
Yeah.
I already have burned the bridge. Oh, God.
I asked Mark this in the middle because he's our timekeeper, too.
Yeah.
And I was worried that we had gone over time. I'm like, oh, my God.
No, but
quickly.
I just know I've been here for 5 years and I want to help them.
I have a writer that I know well, have known well for 3 or 4 years. I'll leave their name out of this. I've published them as an editor before. They submitted a story to this anthology that they very hastily wrote, and I asked for some rewrites. It wasn't a bad idea, and they very hastily put that together, and I said no. Now, I co-edited this book with another person who is extremely close to this writer. They have not spoken in 6 months. That has been her reaction. Now, nobody outside of kind of the publishing house has publicly talked about her reaction, but a huge number of people have noticed, and it does her career a great disservice. Because
make me try and figure out who it is.
just because, do you want to work with somebody when you say no that they're going to throw a temper tantrum?
I want to give an example of this actually from academics because it's always stuck with me, this example. My first job, I got my doctorate in 2002. My first job was at Boston University. And the first day of, more or less, just the first day of meetings, which is like the first day before school gets started, they have a big faculty meeting where everybody gets up and they introduce the various members, new members of each department. They say, you know, where they're from and what their, you know, what their doctorates were in and what their specialties are and all that. It's very nice. So they introduced each of us in turn. And in my year, they had hired, three people total in my department. And this one guy, I couldn't figure out. Now, the job that I was at was a non-tenured, the first job I was at was a non-tenure track job. It was kind of an entry-level professor job, right? I was going to be teaching composition courses and things like that. And you know, it was, and that was fine because it was my first job. But there was another person there who had, he had a doctorate from Stanford, and he had two edited collections from Duke, and he had this stuff and this stuff, and he had been a professor at Harvard, and I was like, I was kind of like, what is he doing here? He's 15 years older than me. I don't get it. Like, nothing on paper. Why is he at the same position that I am? So we get to the introduction of him. And my chairperson, who is very nice, gives the introduction and says, and he taught here and did this and blah, 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 blah. And then he's about to go on, and he stops her. I kid you not. This is a public meeting, right, of the entire faculty of the college, and says, well, actually, I've also been, and then proceeds to go on for another minute to talk about the other schools he'd been at, and the other people he knew, and the other thing. And in the meantime, of course, my chairperson is sitting there kind of, you know, sort of looking at him like this. I'm like, I figured it out. You're here because you're a jerk. That's it. You're a jerk. And I can't even begin to tell you the revelation that was for me, that one of the reasons that I was hired 15 years ahead of this guy, essentially, like the same job, 15 years younger. One of the reasons I got a tenure track job and he didn't wasn't because of my overwhelming brilliance. It was because I wasn't a jerk. It was because I could sit across the table from someone else and be genuinely interested in what it was they have to say. It was that I could sit in a panel with John Helfers and be genuinely interested, not just, no, John would publish my book, but because I thought John had really interesting things to say about publishing, because I wanted to join these folks, because I wanted to spend time interacting with these people genuinely, not because of what it did for me, but because of what I genuinely was interested in spending time with them. That was an enormous revelation for me, and the Burning Bridges example, that guy is going to spend his whole life being 15 to 20 years behind everyone else because he's a jerk, because he spends his time thinking the only thing that matters is, have you noticed the other credentials that I have? And that, I can't even begin to tell you that when you've grown up in a world where you believe that all that matters is which press published you in the academic world and how many credits and what degree and at what time and what the percentages are, and then later who publishes you and how many books you've sold and all that kind of stuff, the revelation that on top of all that is this sense that you have a personal connection with someone else, and if you are a human being that they enjoy and respect and can work with, that will put you so much farther ahead than people who are slightly below brilliant but
but jerks is enormously revelatory to me.
It's kind of pointy, you
would
have
said that.
I noticed that.
Jerks, general over there.
Just to give the other example, and again, I'm not talking about any of the people here since most of them have edited stuff at some point. Editors can burn their own bridges, too.
Oh, my God.
And it's, well, I have been lucky enough not to, I did get one horrific rejection letter. And so I will never work with that market again. And I'll tell you gladly afterwards if you want to hear which market it was, because they were dicks about it. There was no reason for them to be dicks about it, and they were.
I could probably venture a name.
Thank you.
However, there have been, I know at least one editor. I've never worked, every editor who's come to me and said, I would like for you to revise these things or change these things, you know, I've been like, okay, check, done, you know, it's, no questions, because I've been lucky enough to work with really good, really professional people. I have heard of editors who said, "Here, I wrote this scene to add into your story." No, at which point you have that there is a limit to that whole. But now, if you look at it, you're like, "Oh, well, that actually works." Okay, great. But if an editor is like, "Here, I've rewritten parts of your story," that's usually not a good thing. That's kind of over. The editor saying, "I think you need a scene here that adds this. Write that." It is very different than saying, "I've rewritten your story for you." And so there are editors who will screw themselves over as well. So this is not just a one-way bridge kind of thing.
Right.
Don't think it's like the vast conspiracy of publishers and editors out to get you. Again, it's that whole don't be a, you know, be professional. If an editor says, "I want you to change these things," and you feel really strongly that would change your story unrecognizably, say, "I'm sorry, you can withdraw your submission. You will sell it somewhere else. Your baby will find a home eventually."
Let me piggyback off that very quickly. One of the reasons that John, and I'm going to give John a plug here, is one of the reasons that John is such a good editor is that John not only has excellent instincts on it, because he bought my book. No, John does not only has very good instincts as an editor about things that work and things that don't, and things that you didn't see that you should have that you now do once he reveals this to you. But also, John is very, very good at working with an author rather than over them. That is to say that 90% of the recommendations John made, I accepted because I was like, "Yep, absolutely, yes." Then there were about 10% that I wasn't sure about, and we went back and forth on. And John did not say, "No, you will," you know, because we were both professionals working with each other professionally. We both respected each other and said, "Let's, you know, work on this 10% of it as a collaborative portion."
You both had the same goal,
and both had the same goal to produce the best book possible. And that was really, really important, because I didn't know either. I thought I was going to, believe me, some of the academic editors I worked with, I thought that I was going to get to, "And thou shalt do this," and that was not at all the way it was with John. As I say, most of it I accepted because he was right and because I respected his knowledge and so forth. A few things we worked back and forth to come up with something mutually acceptable, and I think John deserves enormous credit for that, not just his skill, but his willingness to work collectively, and I think the best editors do that. You know?
Yeah, we're short on time here. This would probably go on for another hour, but the thing to remember with any editorial is it is collaboration. I mean, you talk about writing as a solitary, lonely business, but the best editors... Their only overwhelming goal should be to make the work written or submitted the best work it can be. Not to rewrite it in their own ego, because that's a sign of a bad editor. That's a sign usually a failed writer. But it's to make it the strongest work it can be. And you know, after writing Greg his check, I'll do the same favor to him that he was very good to work with. And look, there's an author here, I will not name any names, who has not sold anything in I don't know how long. Because they are very hard to take that sort of direction with. They will not take it. They think their words are sacrosanct, and what comes out of their pen is to not be messed with. And that's not true. Everyone, myself and everyone on this panel, needs to be edited. It's not just I should have that edited. They really need to be. You need to have someone else look at that story or that manuscript and say, with an unbiased eye, because the writer is always biased.
Someone meaning not your mom. Someone meaning not your husband, not your wife, not your son or daughter.
There are people who their spouse is their first reader, and they're not pros at it, but they...
With the exceptions at the end of the table, yes.
I know many, many writers, their spouse who is not in the craft is still their first reader.
Yeah. Right, but I want to make one distinction about that. That's true too, and my wife is my first reader. But my point, is not that. My point is that, right, one, a reader is not an editor. Two, the people, if you sort of stop at that moment, because there are so many people who will say, my friends have seen it and said that this is good, and that has nothing, there's not a commentary on the quality of your friends. It has to do with people who are actually in the business and know something about it in particular. Right. And so that's the point.
Let me add something to that, because this is something that we have wrestled with ever since we've met each other. And because we read each other, I don't read all his stuff, but he edits me, and he edits me hard. That doesn't sound right.
Trying not to.
Yes.
All right, well, thanks for coming.
We know a lot of married writers in this business, and to me, the best advice that they give us is also the best advice you can take yourself. And one of them is that the successful have offices that are very far away from each other if they have to be in the same house, and sometimes not in the same house, because it is a lonely, hard craft, and you have to be able to take the criticism. But these people who got together and have a writing partner and end up marrying them, they do very, very well, but they give the same advice. Don't take it personally. You're not going to like the same thing that they do. You have to learn how not to have an ego with it, and it goes on and on and on.
Give each other space to create.
Yes, space. I hate his office. Oh.
Well,
and he goes into mine, he's like, can I touch anything?
I play a lot of tennis, and one of the things with tennis is that you can't get better playing somebody at your skill level or below.
Right.
Yes.
You can enjoy it,
yep.
But you can't get better.
Yep.
And so as you move forward as writers, you're going to find that you'll find somebody who's a really good person for you to give your work to. But as you get better, eventually you'll find that you need to find other people to give work to work with that are better and better. So, you know, when you outgrow John, you know.
I know we're stopping. One very quick thing I want to mention very quickly. On Speculate, we interviewed Betsy Wolheim from Daw. She told us that one of the toughest 10-year period of her life was the period when she was working between the office of Donald Wolheim, her father, who founded Daw, and her mother, who was an editor, you know, on the other room. And so for 10 years, she was between her parents, who she defined as very difficult people, and had to somehow kind of get through it. And so one of the things she said was, hang in. If she could speak to her younger self, she would say, hang in there, this too shall pass. It is very difficult sometimes to work with people you're that close to in that kind of respect.
She gave me that same advice when I was beginning to say, when I was waiting for the finger of you're a failure to happen. She was like, it is tough working with these people since you're so close to them. Hang in there.
Yeah.
You know you're good. I have faith in you. And I'm like, Betsy has faith in me. And you know, you carry those little things around with
you. Yeah, you really
and,
do.
And you know, just no, I'll wait.
Well, we are pretty much at time.
Unfortunately, I'm throwing the questions.
I'd like to do another hour that just would be just nothing but questions.
Yeah. Sorry.
There is another panel in here next that's writing art or craft that'll continue this kind of discussion if you're interested in staying. Thank you all very much for coming.
Yep.
We're going to be downstairs in Author Avenue a lot.
And around.
See us around.
And around.
Please talk to us. Don't. Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks, everyone.
We get
thank you, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you have tickets.